Today we're going to just explore some subjects we haven't had a chance to talk to, more of both a broad view but also a narrow focus in a few areas. And I think our guest is in a great place to give a firsthand account and also some broader views of some of the larger trends about when you're looking at your standard career path, if there is such a thing, there is some white space in there. And there is the old phrase, don't be first, don't be last. Don't invent something new, which I think knocks a few people off for some opportunities out there. And our guest has had a chance in his career to take advantage of some things, and he's had a very successful career because of, in spite of, or in parallel of it, depending upon how you view things. And if you're somebody out there who has an operational mindset, but you also have a very curious intellect that you don't want to do something that everybody has done before, you know, where do you look? What opportunities are out there, and what demands, if you take advantage of these opportunities, there may be on your career if you want to go on that path? And we're going to discuss those things and plus a few others with our guest today for the full hour, Captain Herb Carman, United States Navy. Captain Carman, he's a naval aviator with over 4,000 flight hours in both the E-2 Charlie Hawkeye and the C-2A Greyhound. He previously commanded VAW 116, the Sun Kings. He's presently using up his white space on his work-life balance, pursuing his executive MBA at the Georgetown University McDonough School of Business. He was previously a senior military fellow at the Center for a New American Security. Herb, welcome to MidRats.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Sal.
Hey, I appreciate you taking the opportunity this Sunday to spend some quality time with us here. I wanted to start things off a topic that's near and dear to a lot of people's hearts because they've either experienced it themselves or they know some shipmates who have. But you recently completed an IA, and I just wanted to give an opportunity to, if you could explain to the listeners, what IA did you just come from? What was your mission there in supporting the Long War? And maybe tell us a little bit about some of the people you served with.
Sure. It was a what's known as a service support IA. So it was in support of NAVCENT. And the job was the assistant officer in charge of the NAVCENT Forward headquarters in Kuwait. So what I did is I went out to Kuwait, and if anybody has done an IA before, and has landed in country and gone through Camp Virginia, or come out of country and gone through Warrior Transition Program, I was the assistant officer in charge for the organization that ran that. So I spent the first roughly 7 or 8 months of my time over there at Camp Virginia in Kuwait, bouncing around back and forth between there and Camp Arifjan. Camp Arifjan is where we had the OIC operated, and they have the Warrior Transition Program, which is still down there. We would bring the sailors in on the airplanes and bring them out to Camp Virginia, bed them down, take them through some last-minute admin preparations and some training, and then get them on the road to where they were going. So it was a big logistical effort, making sure that they got to the right place in the right time. And then catching them as they came out of country and getting them down to Warrior Transition Program so we can get them on their way home. And then as the war began to wind down in Iraq, we had to think about how to continue that operation up in another location. So we went up to We went on a trip up to Manas, Kyrgyzstan, and took a look at how operations ran in Manas, Kyrgyzstan, because that's where the Army and the Marines went into Afghanistan from. And so after that, we decided, let's see if we can make this happen. And so then I spent a good portion of my IA tour helping get that prepared, and then at the very end, we stood up a debt there to catch folks and bring them into Afghanistan. So I was the first officer in charge up there, and it was actually, you know, spending time in Afghanistan, spending time in Kuwait and Kyrgyzstan. It was a kind of a IA with a lot of travel, a lot more travel than I expected, but it was It actually turned out to be a really rewarding experience in being able to work real closely with the Air Force and getting set up, all the construction, getting involved with the mission, having really good folks help us get started. From, you know, I cobbled together a team from Afghanistan and from Kuwait to make it happen, and there were some really strong folks on that team that managed to get us up and running within a matter of days. And once we got boots on the ground in Manas.
The interesting thing about Shore Duty, just a quick follow-on before I roll the ball over to my co-host, is since 9/11, the long war, some people like to describe it. I still do. Other people have their own descriptions. But it's well over a decade old, and the IA program is about the same length of time old, and it was always designed and explained as a temporary program that did a few things with magic cards to, you know, you're double counting billets because somebody's actually attached to one UIC, but he's IA over here, so he really doesn't count. You're doing two jobs for the price of one, so to speak. But it's really become a very permanent institution of a designed in a temporary manner, and all the inefficiencies that go into that. At some time in the future, our nation will be challenged again, and the Navy will be called on, or perhaps another service will be called on to support the Navy, depending upon the scenario in the future. But as far as big Navy goes, and having looked at it from your perspective, the way that we assigned, prepared, and executed the IA program, are there some big pixel lessons you think big Navy should look at, if not to improve the program right now, but to look at the next time down the road that they have to recreate a similar system of support for an extended operation that they may want to look real closely at to produce a better system?
Well, in order to answer that, I think it's important for you to know, and I think that you've had a similar experience. When I before I took over as XO of the Sun Kings, I was the chief of staff at the Hawkeye Wing out in Point Magoo, and part of that job was to manage all the IAs that were going from the VAW-VRC community, and we tried to keep a really tight look and making sure that that the wealth was spread out properly, that not one squadron was taking too big of a brunt. We tried to make sure that we were, you know, following business rules. But one, you know, this is the 2006 time frame, and one of the, you know, we were pretty hot and heavy into IAs at that point. You know, probably well over 10,000, I think, at that moment. And one of the things that I wanted to make sure happened that I did not see happening elsewhere was to make sure that we had the right fit for the right billet. The right fit in terms of the individual's career needs, the individual's career impact, the command's operational impact. And so what we did, instead of just picking out a unit and slapping on that IA assignment and say, give me somebody, what we did is asked all the XOs to give us nominees across the board. And then we would take a look at each one of those nominees, and say, okay, this IA looks like it fits this person best and this command best. Let's rank those recommendations and give them to the Commodore to decide. And so where the IA was determined was a step up from where the actual unit was that was providing the IAs. But each one of the units had to, you know, manage who their next nominee would be. You know, in each billet, you can't just say, okay, this is going to be my next guy in the hopper, because the next billet that comes out is, you know, it's for a different rank, or it's for a different designator, or they're looking for a specific skill that somebody may or may not have, or, you know, just 3 months have gone by, and now that guy is the guy that you thought would have been the right guy, is he's getting closer to his roll time, or he just has orders to a next command or something along those lines. And so that's probably the biggest thing that I saw, you know, and throughout the process, and in being involved and being selected myself, was making sure that right fit happens up front, that it's not just throwing down a billet to fill down the road. Now, the billets, themselves have, the numbers have come down significantly over the last year. And I saw this firsthand as I was in Kuwait and in Kyrgyzstan and watching the numbers. And they're going to continue to fall, but they're not going to go away. I think what you're going to see is you're going to see a number significantly lower than what we saw in previous years, and that a majority of the fills will be from the reserve component. And there are some good reasons for some of those IAs to remain in and the reserves to fill them. A lot of reservists enjoy being able to either volunteer to be mobilized for these assignments and get a year doing Navy stuff and making a big impact. But when we look at the billets that are in country, it's really important not to base what those billets are on, say, a request for forces that happened several years back. They constantly need to be reviewed. Because the war changes, the billet changes, the location changes, and so not just from a perspective of keeping track of the individual, but making sure that that job is the right job for a Navy sailor to fill. If they're called for a specific expertise to be, let's say, an information technology professional, and we pick an information technology professional and thin the ranks from the fleet to fill that job, then that's what he should be used for forward, not washing the general's car. Now there are some examples there where that's happened, where they've been used for things that they were not planned to be used for. And some of that, it's sure if you're going to the ISAF staff and you were supposed to go to the 3 and now you're going to the 5, okay, you're still on the ISAF staff. But if you're put in a position where, you were supposed to come out and do an administrative job and they expect you to be running convoys and be the gunner, well, you're not trained for that either. So you need to make sure that those billets are right so that the folks are getting the right training. And then the folks that we're pulling out from the fleet are the right folks to pull from the fleet. Because we had a lot of billets out there that were low density, high demand, and want to make sure that when we're pulling those guys out, that they're the right guys to pull.
Well, that's a pretty interesting question. I mean, I've got a lot of questions along these lines, but let me start with a basic one. If someone goes IA, and they're basically given up by a squadron or a ship or some other unit, what's that do to their career? I mean, given where you're sitting and having had the experience of both assigning and being an IA, what's that do to their career path?
Well, that's one of the reasons why I say you've got to make sure you've got the right career impact on the individual, because depending on the timing, it can have a pretty bad impact on where someone is. If they don't have the time to complete their milestone qualifications and the type of job that they are, it could either set them back or knock them out of what was a planned career path. And, in aviation, how tight it is now to the career paths are very set. And if you get too far away from that set path, it can kind of throw a monkey wrench in where you need to be and, whether you need to finish up that first JO tour and get to that shore-duty instructor tour. So that's one consideration to making sure that you've got the right guy. And also, the boards have, like selection boards and promotion boards, they have a precept in there and they talk about, IA tours. And I think the guys need to make sure that they know that if they're an average performer, doing an IA tour is not going to make them the number one guy. I think that you just need to make sure that there's some realistic expectations on what an IA tour is going to do for somebody. If a guy is in the hunt for the next promotion or the next selection, then an IA may help. But if the guy was not in the hunt to begin with, an IA is probably not going to fix that. And that's just my perspective on that. And I think that there's some guys that have expectations that the IA is going to fix things that they just plain aren't going to fix. And so you really need to be realistic about, as a skipper, you need to be realistic about telling a guy, telling a guy what the IA is going to do or not going to do for them professionally. But the IA, the IA tour, after leaving command, I really didn't have any expectation of doing an IA. And then when the IA came up, I was already well into school as well into work and had to put some things on hold to go on that IA tour. So was I the happiest camper when I was picked? Probably not. But when I got out there and had the chance to work in that environment again, and it was, you're in Kuwait in the summertime and it's hot and you're trying to make sure things get going right and it's complex and logistically it's challenging, and you've got a large command spread out throughout the country, and you've got a plan for the next things going on and what's going to happen when Iraq shuts down and all those things that go along with that. It turned out to be a very rewarding experience, and having that opportunity there to be with sailors again and running around and doing stuff, it was well worth the interruptions and the rest of the life plan there. That I think that the reward there was being able to be a part of something that I would not have been able to be a part of otherwise.
I had a very very similar feeling that you did. I mean, in some ways, you look around you and you know you're on the island of misfit toys, but the experiences that most people have on IAs, in some ways, I think it's a lost opportunity in two ways. You can just look at the board results, and that answers all questions that you may have had. I think your caution for both leaders, but also those people that are going for IAs, avoid great expectations, avoid the spin, look at the facts, know what you're going into, but also know there are larger things you're doing besides that, because really the career advice now after a decade of war is very little changed than it was in the late 90s. And I think that's unfortunate in some ways. And you also, there's some messages that we're sending. When you look at, and as a reminder to everybody, Herb is speaking for himself, neither represents the Department of Defense or the Department of the Navy. I meant to mention that early on, even though I put it in the show preps. And I'm not going to use any names here, but you can look at the bios of some of our more recently promoted senior O&E leaderships. And it really it doesn't reflect where that has been rewarded properly. Are the other services treating those that have gone forward more better in their promotion rates, the Air Force, the Army, and the Marines? Or is the Navy perhaps looking at it differently than the other services?
Well, I can't really speak to how the Air Force is doing it with their jet airmen. Their jet airmen is along the lines of the IA process. But I can say that the guys that I've seen in the expeditionary wings, the guys that have filled squadron commander jobs, wing commander and deputy commander jobs, they've done well. But remember that a lot of those guys come to those jobs from being, say, the deputy wing commander of some place back in CONUS, and they go to be a wing commander in one of the expeditionary wings, and then they go back. Or same thing with a squadron or a group commander as well. So from that perspective, I think that there's probably a little bit more structure as far as where that fits in, the expeditionary piece. The Army is, from the folks that I've talked with, if you are not going forward with your unit, then that presents an uphill battle if you're a battalion commander. So there's an aspect of, making sure that you try to, career-wise and trying to get into a unit that's going forward. And I think that there's probably some caution to that because there's some, valuable things that guys can be doing and great leadership that guys need to have back when they're in CONUS. From my perspective on my CO tour, that we had both deployed and we had spent time back on the beach. And that time back on the beach was in some ways just as challenging as the time at sea because we had several, major maintenance evolutions, aircraft transfers, getting airplanes ready for other squadrons. And so you can't, I think it does a disservice to say that the only way a guy can make colonel is for him to be or her going forward as a battalion commander into the fight. And then you just have to take a look at what incentives does that set up as well. Does that mean that, you're trying to set up rotations or you're modifying rotation cycles and things like that for reasons that are not tactical or operational reasons, it's something to look at. The Air Force, I think it's got a pretty solid way of doing things. Guys who have gone forward have done well. So that's just the difference that I've seen from being over there and from the guys that I know, in the building, in the Army too, that have picked up battalion command and have picked up colonel or getting to that point where they're approaching the next milestone too.
Well, when you were coming up through the fleet, what kind of things motivated you to stay on active duty and not go off and fly for East Podunk Airline or something? What kept you going as in your trade?
Well, that's a good question. I talked about this with some of my classmates at school this weekend. In fact, when I was up for this was back probably 2000 or so when I was a lieutenant. I was an instructor at the at the FRS for the E2s and the C2s, and I was really enjoying life there because I had come to the squadron having already done a tour in E2s and already done a tour in C2s, so I was pretty much involved. Anytime they had a carrier landing practice debt or a carrier qual debt, I got to go because if Herb was on the debt and he was qualed in both, and if somebody dropped out, then I could jump in the other airplane and go, which was really a great position to be in as a instructor pilot. So I was getting close to that point, and you got to think back there, 99, 2000, there was a big push for guys to go to the airlines at that point. A lot of guys, a lot of my classmates did, a lot of my peers did. Some of them have done really well and have really enjoyed different opportunities in the airlines. For me, I wasn't really sure I had that same desire to be an airline pilot per se. And I was looking at, what other kind of flying jobs I could do and that sort of thing. But I hadn't really made up my mind to stay in the Navy at that point. And what it was there was a, I forget what year it was, but I know it was November, and I know it was I think it was the TR. We're doing carrier qual debt, and the aircraft was parked up by the Belknap pole, and the weather was really really rough. So we had waves that were spraying water up onto the bow, and the deck was pitching around, and the deck was rolling, and we had just gotten done pre-flighting, and we were the only E2s and C2s on the deck. And the student came around as we got into the plane, got done pre-flight, and he looks at me and goes, "Are we really going flying in this?" With eyes as big as saucers, and slapped him on his shoulder and said, "Of course we are. We're going right now. So get in the plane. Let's go." And as I was walking to the plane right then, I decided there was no other place that I wanted to be. So when I came back, I put in my paperwork to take the bonus and stick around for the rest of the time. So that was the moment that I decided to stick around.
Well, I think and those in the aviation side of the house can appreciate the fact that especially in this day and age, you don't get 4,000 flight hours by leaving sea duty quickly and soaking up shore duty billets on a regular basis. So you've been out there and definitely have earned your time forward. But one of the other fun things I like about your CV is, outside of the cockpit, of course, is you have some experience with your little corner involvement with the Federal Executive Fellowship. A lot of people may have heard that or seen that on people's CV before. If you could, explain to us what exactly it is, who is it for, and what does it do and how does it help the Navy to take officers out of a normal career path and to slot them in there?
Well, I was really lucky to get into this program. I had applied to go to the Paul Mill Master's Program, which is a similar program that sends officers out, a handful of officers, to schools like Hopkins and Georgetown and Tufts to go get a master's degree in a Paul Mill type master's program. And the year that I was putting my package in, the board came back, and I was number 5, and there were only 4 slots. And so I kind of said, okay, well, that's not going to happen, and started moving on. And then a couple months later, got a phone call from some folks in OpNev N51, and they were looking to fill a Federal Executive Fellowship position at the Center for New American Security. And, having followed what they've done and followed what they've written and, regularly read Andrew Exum's blog, I knew right away what that was and knew right away that was something I would be interested in doing. So I jumped on that opportunity. And what it is, it's a one-year academic year fellowship for, 04 to 06 officers. And you spend a year at a think tank, whether it's Brookings or CSIS or someplace like Stanford, the Hoover Institute out at Stanford, and you actually work right alongside guys that are making policy as it's being done. At the end of that year, you come away with a 2000 coded subspecialty. You don't get it. You don't get a master's. You don't get the JPME, and then you do a payback in a strategy, Paul Mill strategy type job. So, my payback is with the N52 folks at OpNav. It could be a J5 type job afterwards. I can't speak enough for how enjoyable that year was. It was getting to work alongside some really fantastic people that were right in the thick of how national security policy was being made and being decided, and right in there in the sitting at the table for discussions on what we should be looking at in the future, what we should be looking at in the current operations. And it was an amazing opportunity, and then I had also worked with some folks that were working on their natural security team there at CNAS, and I got to be involved in their projects as well, and got to help publish and edit, and got to write in blogs, and got to get to folks that from other think tanks and around the city. So, it was a really amazing a career broadening opportunity, an opportunity to meet folks and network with folks that I would have never had the chance to meet. And it was, what was enjoyable about it was that, here I am as a guy who had spent the previous 19 years, all but, 17 and a half of them in the cockpit, and then thrown into this environment in DC. And it was funny because I was probably there a week, and had a, we were sitting at a table having a discussion, about 12 of us. And at the end of that discussion, John Nagle was the president of CNAS at that point. And I asked John to stick around and just for a second, because I needed them to explain what I had just experienced and what had just happened. And he kind of, you know, gave me about a 20-minute dump on, okay, well, you know, this person was here because he wanted to explain his thoughts on this policy, and we wanted to hear this side of it. And so it was just, you know, being able to understand more about how that worked. It was really a great opportunity.
As you look down the road and people who you were the commanding officer of, did you bring some of them along? How do we professionally develop our? How did you professionally develop young officers to kind of follow in your footsteps as future leaders of the Navy?
Well,
is that a general question?
That's a pretty general question. one of the things that I probably have done differently with guys, and guys come to me, and I still get regular emails from the guys who were my JOs, or they get a question about what they should do for their, their next job, or they've got a question about what steps they might want to take in their career. And I think one of the things that I've done differently is probably said, okay, I want you guys to really, really have an open mind about what can be next. And that I don't want you guys to think that if you come to me and tell me that you're thinking about getting out or you're thinking about doing something that's outside the norm, that I'm going to look at that negatively, because I think that's unfair to those guys. I mean, they need to be able to think through the things themselves and make those career decisions themselves and understand the impacts and the values of each side of the equation. So, you know, I encourage guys, you know, look, if you want to go get your airline transport pilot's license, go ahead and do that, because it's going to help you make that decision, and it's going to help you understand what it takes to on the other side, and also it's going to make you a better aviator. And the same thing goes with deciding about whether you want to take that next job in the Pentagon as a lieutenant. You know, you got to be able to sit down with the guy and look him in the face and say, okay, there are some risks to doing this. Okay, so understand that there are risks. And if you really, really want to do this, let's talk through and write this out about what is and what isn't, and we'll make sure we got it right. But I never wanted to look at a guy and say, look, just because you've told me that, you know, you're a lieutenant now, you've got several years left, because you told me one time that you're thinking about maybe not sticking around, that I'm going to grade your performance on your performance. And I've had guys come back to me and say, you know what, I thought I was going to get out, and at the end of that next tour, I decided I was going to stay in. I had that same decision process when I was a lieutenant. So I think it's important to let those guys think on their own and make their own decisions, but also help them understand the impact of those decisions and let them think broadly.
Along those lines, I've got to slightly modify my question because you already answered it in the last 2 minutes, and that's a good thing. I think one of the disservices that can take place to a young man or woman in their career is when they are given advice or given an offer they can't refuse. It sends them to an important community job that is, quote, good for them, unquote, or good for their career, so to speak, or somebody else wants them there, but it's really not a good fit for their personality or for their skill set, because, you know, different people have different personality types, different skill sets, different ways of working. You spend a fair bit of time in D.C., and there are some people who really, really thrive in the type of billets that are available in D.C., but there are others that would probably be, even if it was a great select billet, that it's probably not a place where they'd want to go. What's a good personality fix for a set of DC orders if you were looking at, you know, just a generic personality 1, 2, 3 of somebody who probably would not only enjoy DC, but would probably do really well in the type of billets that are available there?
Well, I don't know if there's like a specific personality. I think there's just some things to understand about DC. that you know you're in a job in D.C. and as someone mentioned quite recently that things move pretty slowly, and that when you look back and you measure what your accomplishments are. Sometimes you have to measure those accomplishments in a micrometer as opposed to a yardstick and so it's you just have to understand that the process is just different in the headquarters. That there are culturally some things that you know in the headquarters that are different, and it's not the fleet, and that you know there's sort of a withdrawal period that you know from a guy who's had a lot of time at sea, you come back and you go to a place that is a big staff and is moving slowly. There's a natural tendency a few months into that tour to wish to be back out at sea again, and that I would say that's a natural reaction because it's a different environment and it takes time to adjust to it. Some guys don't ever. Adjust to it. Some guys come back for multiple tours, and I don't know that you can really say that there's one type of personality that fits. I just think that you know it's kind of an individual thing, and you know some of those things about going to a staff aren't any different whether that staff is in D.C. or that staff is in even someplace nice like Stuttgart. There are definitely things that are different about being at sea and different about being on a staff, and that you just have to learn what they are, you know, and from a guy, you know, it's funny, you know, guys have a tough time going from being a CO to having a cubicle to fly. And it takes a little bit of time. You know, you had the parking spot right outside the door. Now you're in North parking and it takes you a while to get to your office. Those things are different. And it also helps you recognize that, a command position is a position. It's not an individual. So when you leave that job, you are again, Commander Joe Bag. You're not the commanding officer anymore. So it's there are some wake up calls that guys have when they come to a big job like that.
This is going to sound a little more off the wall than usual for me, maybe, but. How much role does luck play in Navy careers? I mean, it seems to me some people, this is where I'm coming from, some people start out flying H-46s. They do away with Navy H-46s, and they end up flying H-60s, it puts them in a different screwy career path. And she is an outstanding young officer, but aren't they kind of screwed because the pattern got changed through no fault of their own? And is there any way we could fix that kind of situation if it needs to be fixed?
Well, I think that there is some element of luck. There's a huge element of timing, as you guys know. We've seen the transitions, the sundowns of the A6, the S3, the F14, and folks moving to different communities from those jobs, and it's been difficult for some, to make that transition. But I saw that when I was a CO, I saw guys come into the E2 community that did extremely well as. Jumping into the cockpit as an XO of a squadron in an E2 squadron, having been S3s his whole life, and I just think that it's really important for guys to be able to have that opportunity to make that transition, because a guy that's successful in one aircraft is likely to be successful in another. They just need to be afforded the time to train in that aircraft, and then the time to get to that magical 500-hour mark in that aircraft, because that's about when guys get comfortable. You know, and this is probably fixed wing. It could be a totally different number when you're talking rotary wing. But guys need to be able to fly and fight the airplane. So I think that the same thing is is true when you know, you select who your air wing commanders are. And if there's a guy coming along that wasn't wasn't necessarily a Hornet pilot coming up through, and he's got to build up those skills to be able to fly that airplane just as well. And just because he was just because he was one type airplane doesn't mean he can't fly another, can't learn how to fly another. There's some different mindsets, different cultures and things like that, but guys can learn to adjust to that.
Hey, I heard that dog whistle. Speaking of platforms, you'd be a good person to roll this little question by. One of my little frustrations is I always thought that Big Navy was penny wise and pound foolish when it just forgot and decided not to go forward with the common support aircraft. And in the last few couple of months, you've seen more people talking about, well, you know, the C-2 is long in the tooth. We'll just replace it with the V-22. And one of the rejoiners to that a few days ago that I kind of did the I could have had a V-8 moment is we are running a pretty nice E-2 Delta line right now. And, of course, the C-2 was a derivative of the E-2 Alpha. And the question would be, from the E-2 C-2 community point of view, is there a fair bit of agnostic attitude towards the V-2 coming on board? And is there anything more besides the written word of looking at leveraging what's already being done with the E-2 Delta line and maybe giving us some new C-2s?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And there was, you know, I've been loosely following this, and I'm getting further and further apart from where folks stand on this. You know, there was a analysis of alternatives a long time ago about V-22. Should V-22 replace the C-2, and what would be the follow-on aircraft to the carrier on board delivery mission? And I don't know. I don't really know where all that is at this point. What I do know, there are some differences. I mean, the V-22, it has somewhat similar speed, but, you know, can it haul for as long a distance? One of the things to really look at is that with the C-2 or whatever that follow-on may be, that you need to take a look at what that does to your forward logistics site. Not just look at it from an aircraft perspective, but what does this do to your forward logistics site and then your aircraft carrier? So what operational flexibility does that carrier on board delivery aircraft provide you? Can you put that ship in a place further out that you could not put it before? Or are you making a decision that's going to have to bring you closer to that forward logistics site in order for you to maintain that logistics chain?
One of the interesting arguments that I saw as well, that again is one of the things that when I read it I went duh, is just if we're able to do that, you automatically are able to do what we're doing right now, which is instead of having AIMD and onboard spares for the V-22, which carriers usually don't carry, the you'll be able just to work off the E-2 that's already there. So there'd be a savings, if nothing else, just being able to add on to the E-2 line if you could do the engineering.
Yeah, I think you really have to nug down into that and look at that, because there's a – although the airplanes are very similar, the airframes are very similar, there are a lot of differences in the aircraft repairable parts. So you don't have an actuator on one does not work on the other, and so I think before you have to draw that assumption, you have to really map that out and look at whether that would actually be a savings or not. For example, the C2 engine has a different engine than the E2. Now they have the same prop system on them, but I'm not sure that the prop system all the way, you know, front to back is the same prop system as the E2. So, you know, taking a look at making sure that you've got a real savings from commonality perspective is important. And the other thing too is that it's when you're making sure that you've got the right logistics aircraft, you have to look at what the right logistics stream is to the ship. And there's a, you know, a the reliance on getting those spare parts overnight is pretty big to a CAGMO. And so you want to be able to make sure that he's getting what he needs to get from the beach to keep his jets up, and need to make sure there's the right stream to make sure the right number of passengers can flow to and from the beach. Because that's, you know, that's another issue too, is you get certain cycles for the ship where you need to get a lot of passengers on and off the ship. And, you know, sometimes, you know, obviously you need to augment them with other aircraft like the H-53, but you should make sure that you're weighing all that out, what the demand signal really is. And then, you know, making sure that, okay, if the demand signal doesn't fit, what changes do you need to make to your supply system? Do you need to up the number of spares on board the ship in an anticipation of not being able to make the overnight run to and from the beach? Or, you know, are you going to need to have more of that carrier on board delivery aircraft at the forward logistics site in order to support the carrier? You know, it's a bunch of different things that I think that you can't really weigh out as an image of one aircraft versus another. I think you really need to look at what the aircraft missions do, and then what the changes are to that logistics chain along the way.
I get so excited when people talk about logistics. And it didn't, even though I was started out in logistics force, it didn't strike me until I was fairly well into my service how important logistics were. At what point did you find, Herb, that logistics was a really important topic?
Well, you know, my first tour was in CODS, and it was when I really took a look at what was going out on and off the ship. It kind of opened my eyes up to the things that were important to the ship. Back then we were still flying, not in the squadron I was in, but the West Coast squadrons were still flying overnight COD flights out to the ship. And, you know, talking to those guys and understanding what they were carrying out as well. But I think the really big moment that, you know, that struck me about how important it was when I stepped into that chair as a maintenance officer in VW-115 out in Japan. You know, you're out there, you're FDNF, and you're looking at what it takes to get the spares that you need out to your squadron, you know, all the way out in Japan, and, you know, trying to make sure that you're able to fly not just airplanes that can go airborne, but airplanes that are also tactically mission capable. You know, it's not good enough to just have a sled, you know, that can do carrier quals, but when you're out there in FDNS, you got to make sure you've got radars and links and all the other systems that go along with that. So, you know, making sure you've got the WRA-30 that works, and that the guy in the AMD shop knows how to fix it, and that, you know, if you got to run it down to the kitty hawk to run it through the bench to make sure that it works and find out whether you can piece together a card and, you know, all those pieces of that go into that. And so that was... It was a good experience for me to have, because when I, you know, came back and was chief staff officer of the wing, I got to be involved with some of that readiness stuff again. And, you know, now from a community perspective of where we are with what the E-2 needs, what the C-2 needs. And the difference to me, it was, you know, pretty interesting to talk about, like, okay, where the E-2D is and where the C-2A is. Even back when I was a lieutenant as a RAG instructor, we had discussions about what the E-2 needs. And, you know, there were discussions about, you know, either improved radar boxes that were more reliable, which is something that the E-2s always struggle with, or you know, so the next big system on that aircraft. And then the C-2 was always talking about, well, we need to make sure that we have the outer wing panels that work, and we need to make sure that we have actuators, and that we had the ramp closes right. So there's a big difference from one to the other, and that we've done a good job of holding on to that C-2 and keeping that C-2 flyable, because I think that, you know, when I was a young lieutenant, we were on a path where that airplane would have been out of service by now had we not made some changes to how we operated it.
Yeah, she isn't sexy, but she is real important. And speaking of your community, I think a few parts of the military in the last decade have kind of been as silent as the ballistic missile submarine force, and the fact that, you know, there aren't any headlines and what's going on, people are interested in other things. But with the announcement of the Pacific pivot and with the winding down of our land wars in Asia, so to speak, is few things scream about the importance of maintaining SA and the air warfare picture than the Pacific, just from the amount of square nautical miles that needs to be covered, and the fact that the other large party at the other end of the pond, so to speak, is looking at, back when you and I were kids, reopening the backfire challenge with a new production pipeline domestically in China. And there's also the talk of the anti-ship ballistic missile threat and supersonic cruise missiles. I mean, it really is a time for the airborne picture professionals to really start, you know, having their puzzler about this challenge. How has that reinvigorated the community, or is the community being reinvigorated about this challenge for a long time, and it's just nice to see some of the attention coming their way?
Well, I think that the what's really interesting to watch is as the E-2 comes out and hearing the guys talk about the capabilities that the E-2 brings, that the advanced Hawkeye is really going to be able to, you know, with a radar that's significantly better than what the radar we have in the airplane now. Just that alone is going to be a huge improvement to the warfare capability of that aircraft. You know, when I was a CO, one of the last things that I did was take the squadron up to Alaska, and we participated in a red flag exercise. And, you know, the first day or two of that red flag exercise, you sit down at the table with your Air Force counterparts and discuss, you know, capabilities and limitations, and you get to have a feel for the understanding of what the Air Force brings to the table, and they get to gain an understanding for what the Naval Aviation brings to the table. And to me, that was just really the beginning of the discussion. You know, that you hear this discussion about what air-sea battle is, and to me, that sounds like, from what I can gather, it sounds like that's a great carry-on of the discussion of bringing together capabilities and understanding how we fight together. So you know, that piece of it to me is really important too, because it's not you know, we've tended to be platform centric, I think, and you know, and I'm glad to see that we're starting to tie together capabilities and really look at doing the nug work of making sure that the tactics are working, and we're not relying on some, you know, idealistic you know, model of what warfare should be in the future, that we're really putting pencil to paper, and that we know we're making sure that what we're doing is really going to make us better warfighters, because that's really what the whole purpose of, you know, building an airplane to do is that it's a warfighting aircraft, and that you can't just you know, come up with a dream of what it's going to be. You've actually got to make it do it.
I'm a black shoe. Not only am I a black shoe, I'm a reserve black shoe. But so this will be a question asked out of pure ignorance. Has there been a member of the community you belong to, the ETW and C2 community that's had command of a carrier? And if not, is there any possibility there would be such a command available?
Well, actually, it's good you bring that up. It's like I saw that has changed over time since when I was, you know, when I was a lieutenant to today, and we've got you know, Admiral Klunder was a E-2 air wing commander, he was an air wing commander, who's an E-2 pilot by background. You have Rear Admiral Shalansky, who just finished up command of the Truman Carrier Strike Group, but he was CO of the Truman as well. So you've seen E-2 guys take positions as air wing commanders. My immediate boss in the Pentagon right now is a former E-2 air wing commander. So, you know, from that perspective, that, you know, we talked about this when I was a young JO, that there was a glass ceiling and that we need to make a change. And you know, look, over time, it has been, and it's not just it's not just E2 guys that make that happen. It's a culture and a community that's willing to broaden who's running the show, and I think that's, you know, it's important to have that kind of diversity of experience in those types of jobs.
One thing I wanted to touch on before we departed the pattern, so to speak, is you're working on your executive MBA, which I think is a great program. I know you're doing in D.C. I don't know what percentage of your class is military or former military background, but in my experience, it was a great opportunity to share ideas with people who have no connection to the military, no connection to the defense industry. I know, and I think a lot of it has to do with people of a certain generation didn't enjoy TQL in the mid-90s, and they kind of harumphed at, you know, business practices and some of the bingo words that are unfortunately come from people who only read one book on management and do a two-week MBA program. But there are some concepts in the business world that, whether you're talking about leadership or project management or just looking smart at money, that really do enhance an officer's intellectual tool set. What are some of the experiences you've had so far with your executive MBA program that maybe has tickled your rib or lighted a bulb for you?
Well, I could probably talk on about 20 minutes about this one. We just got back from an international trip to India. Would have never been able to go to India and look at it from a business perspective. We've talked about strategy looking at different ways to look at strategy from a business perspective that you can apply to regular, you know, military strategy. We've looked at management communications changed things. I've gone to class and come back on Monday and changed the way I was, build my next staffing package based on what we had studied in school. So it's from that perspective, every day I go to class, I come back, I'm able to apply something back at the office, which is important. And, it's one of the reasons why, one of the reasons why I'm going to school in the first place. And then having the classmates that are, you know, from all different companies around the D.C. area. If I've got classmates from Chicago, I've had classmates from Atlanta, from New Jersey, and different organizations, different industries, really talented folks. And that was really one of the reasons why I decided on Georgetown, was that you have that diversity in the classroom, and then we had the part of Georgetown that I enjoyed was the Jesuit side of it too. Not, you know, I'm not Jesuit or Catholic, but just that values piece that you don't get to necessarily have in an educational environment. And so pulling all those things together, made sense that was the right degree for me to do.
Well, I think it's great, and I hope it's an opportunity that other people in the course of their career, if not at Georgetown, some other major institution that has a real campus with real students and a good reputation, that they take advantage of that opportunity, because I think it really does add and enhance everybody's tool set. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention to the listeners, if you've enjoyed our conversation we've had today with Captain Carmen, if you're up on Twitter, go ahead and follow Herb over at Herb Carmen over on Twitter. But I think, as you counseled me a few months ago, if you want to retweet him, though, you have to do it old school. So at Herb Carmen over there. And I just wanted to thank you a lot for taking time this Sunday afternoon to spend with us. It's been a real quick hour, and it's been a great joy.
All right. Thank you, Sal. Thank you, Vaughn.
Yeah. Thanks, sir. Have a pleasant weekend.
And I'd like to thank everybody for joining us today. And make sure and join us again next week. for another live edition of MidRats. And until then, I want to wish everybody a great Navy Day. Cheers.
I just figured out that if I switch to Metro PCS, I get two Samsung Galaxy phones free.
Cool, Dad.
And I could be a super dad with two free Samsung Galaxy phones and call myself Double Galaxy Man.
Or you could give the second phone to your sidekick.
Yeah, I guess I could do that.
That's right. Two free Samsung Galaxy On 5 smartphones are all yours when you switch to Metro PCS. Metro PCS. Wireless. Figured out.
Coverage not available in some areas. Sales tax not included in phone price. Excludes numbers on the T-Mobile network. See store for details and terms and conditions.
It's the holidays, and Dickie's Barbecue knows you got lists to check twice. One trip to Dickie's.com takes care of holiday caterings and parties. Dickie's has a slew of ways to cater or just take home a family pack at the last minute. Slow smoked meat, savory sides, be more popular than Santa himself. Catering and family packs make the party right. Right, Mr. Dickie?
Right you are, Chris, at Dickie's We Speak Barbecue.
This Sunday, every Sunday, kids eat free at Dickie's Barbecue. Come on in and get you some.